welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. And if your holiday giving feels overwhelming, what if it were as simple as one need, one day, and one child at a time? Coming up in just a bit, we'll visit with Sarah Rivers from the God's Child Project, an organization walking alongside children and families through education, healthcare, housing, and long-term hope. As we begin Main Street today, we're exploring a cutting-edge project at the University of North Dakota that's straight out of science fiction, but it's very real. UND has built a laser communication optical ground station that's first fully operational university-operated laser communications ground station in the United States. And in simple terms, this means that researchers and students in Grand Forks can use lasers to communicate with satellites in space, dramatically increasing data speeds and security. Our guest is one of the people leading this pioneering effort, Dr. Marcus Alghieri. He's an assistant professor of physics and astrophysics at the University of North Dakota. Dr. Alghieri is a quantum optics expert who joined UND in 2024 and helped build the facility. And he's here to tell us all about it, from his own journey into this field to how UND students are involved and why laser communications could change the world. Dr. Alghieri, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Happy to talk to you today.
We are really pleased that you are with us. All right. Can you explain for our general audience what this laser communications optical ground station actually is, and what does it do, and why is it a big deal?
Yeah, I mean, the name, when you call it that, the laser communication optical ground station, is a little bit of a mouthful. So usually in short, we just call it the space laser.
Okay.
Because it's a little bit more memorable and a little shorter. So where to start? When you have a spacecraft or a satellite that's in orbit, so that could be something like the International Space Station or the Space Shuttle or any satellite that's orbiting Earth right now, right? You need ways to talk to it, to communicate. And up to this point, almost all of that communication happens with radio frequencies. So kind of like a walkie-talkie to space. And that works. That works just fine, but there are some limitations on the communication speed that you have. So whenever you do this communication, it goes through a ground station somewhere. So you have your spacecraft, and then you have a ground station on Earth that does our part of the communication. So for the future, we would like to switch from radio frequencies to optical wavelengths and to use lasers for the communication. And there's a lot of benefits that could come out of that, like much faster communication speeds, and we can talk about what that means. But so for that, you need an entirely different ground station, which is an optical ground station. And so one of the big differences is you need optics, you need lasers, and you need mirrors and lenses to point light the way it needs to go. And radio frequencies, in a way, go more or less everywhere. You can aim them a little bit, but with a laser, you have to be very precise. So you have to know exactly where your satellite, your spacecraft is, and point your optics in that direction to send signals and to receive signals. And that's what we're building here.
You know, it struck me that we have a couple different kinds of satellites that are orbiting the Earth, right? We have geosynchronous satellites that are kind of in the same place relative to us all the time. And then you have things moving around, like the International Space Station. Can you communicate with either?
I think so. The majority of satellites, almost all satellites that are in orbit, are in what we call a low Earth orbit. So think of that something between 100 and 400 miles up. And the main reason for that is that a lot of things are a lot harder when you're further away. Your geosynchronous satellites, those are things like GPS satellites sometimes, sat phone satellites. Those would be a couple 10,000 miles away. So everything's a lot harder when things are that far away. And also it is a lot more expensive and harder to get them there in the first place. So almost all satellites, right? Your old-fashioned TV satellites, Starlink, communication satellites, weather satellites, those are all hovering a couple hundred miles up.
One other thing I've thought about before we continue on, is space junk ever a problem? Does stuff ever get in the way?
It absolutely does. I mean, that's not my department, but when you talk to satellite operators, that's part of their day-to-day business to know where their satellite is, to know where other operator satellites are and where all the defunct and old satellites are, and to make sure things don't bump into each other.
So I have this beam of light that's coming to my house. It's fiber-based internet service, right? It's mm-hmm. the light's generated from somewhere, and it travels around a cable through a strand of optical fiber, and boom, it's in my house, and now we have pretty fast internet speeds. Is this the same inherently? We're communicating via light, or is this really different?
You're absolutely right. It's the same basic idea, right? So compare your radio frequency link to a satellite to your old dial-up modem that used your landline. And that used electromagnetic signals, or in kind of the radio frequency spectrum. And that works. It's very reliable, but it's not the fastest. And then eventually we're all getting optical fiber to our house. And that gives us a lot higher data rates, right? And basically the internet, what it is today, would never have been possible without that, right? Optical fibers are the backbone to all communications, that even if you don't have optical fiber to your house, probably somewhere out on the street, there is an optical fiber that picks it up. And so the hope is to get that same like boost to the functionality with satellite communication.
I'm curious too, and I don't want to get in deep into mathematics because I remember nothing from my classes that I took, but I did take a class in the theory of error correcting codes. So are you using that sort of technology where you are sending information to a satellite, realizing that you might drop a bit here and there that we had to worry about with modems and with other radio-based communications, but still we could get the whole message because of some mathematics applied to whatever scheme that we were using? Or is this a perfect way to communicate?
No, it's definitely not perfect. So you would need to do those things like manage dropouts and channel losses. And those can be very common with optical communication because you need a line of sight, right? The fiber to your house doesn't just randomly disconnect and reconnect. But when you're shooting light through the entire atmosphere, there's turbulence happening, there is water vapor that could absorb your signal, there are clouds moving through.
An airplane.
So maybe an airplane even. If you imagine a satellite passes overhead and it goes from horizon to horizon on the other side, there will be all kinds of things in the way. So how strong your signal is will change throughout that. Maybe you're not doing a very good job tracking the satellite. There may be clouds. So you're inevitably going to have those dropouts and you have to manage those. That's right.
All right. This is the first for a university, and the UND's press release called it the first fully operational laser-com ground station at a university in the United States. So how did UND end up leading the nation in this space laser race, if you will? And this isn't something you see on every campus.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's something that UND is very good at, but I also have to say that UND is hardly the first university or facility in the US that does something like that. So for example, years ago, when NASA announced the Artemis missions to the moon, they decided that they will probably need something like laser communication for that. And they started to do demonstrations of the basic technology at their own facilities, like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or other government labs like MIT Lincoln Lab. So that stuff has been around, but it hasn't been very accessible or repeatable. And there wasn't really an outlook of doing this commercially. And that is what has changed in the last couple of years, mostly with the Space Development Agency that is moving into Grand Forks Air Force Base, deciding that they would do laser communication for all their future satellites. So that, I think, was the impetus to get this started in this fashion. And so that got woven into the national security initiative that we have at UND here, right? And we have people at UND whose entire job is to develop these strategic initiatives and look into what is up and coming, where might there be a need for workforce development and training people and developing technology. So that was the basic idea. And that all happened before the legislative session 2023. So UND noticed that there is a need for these things that are related to national security. And that is not just things that have to do with the Department of Defense or anything like that. A lot of that has to do with things like important technologies or supply line issues. For example, you probably remember a couple of years ago, there was this microchip shortage where you couldn't get a car from a dealer for a while. You remember that? That was not very pleasant. So what came out of that are things like the CHIPS Act, right, that funneled a lot of money in developing more facilities and developing infrastructure and supply lines. So that is what we is also what we mean with this national security initiative. And yeah, so one of the topics that we identified in that initiatives was this optical communication. And that definitely happened through talking to people at government agencies like the Space Development Agency that are local here to Grand Forks. Yeah, and from there on, it moved fairly quickly. So in 2023, the university requested funding for such a facility from the state and got the $5 million that we put through towards this facility. And that was around the time that I was hired. So I took it over from there.
Let's talk about your journey. It's interesting. I think you're originally from Germany and you've worked in quantum optics and even environmental science. So how did you end up taking advantage of this opportunity, as you talked about the timeline here for just a moment, spearheading this space laser project? What's your path?
That's a good question. Most of it was purely by happenstance. So yeah, I did most of my education in back home in Germany. So I went to college to get a master's, got a PhD in optics, and that was all adjacent to telecommunication. So I didn't grow up professionally shooting lasers at satellites. That's not something that's ever happened. In fact, I still haven't shot a laser at a satellite. That's a future thing, right? So back in 2019, I moved to the US for a research job at the University of Oregon. And that came pretty naturally through a personal connection. So the research group I worked in, the professor that led the lab, had also just moved back to the US from a job in England. So the lab that I did my PhD in Germany and his group in England, we had a collaboration going. So basically there was someone who was in my professional bubble who was looking for someone to start a help start a new lab in the US, and Oregon seemed like a nice enough place to move to. So that's how I ended up in the US, and I stayed there, and I liked certain parts of the academic culture in the US and certainly the people and the great outdoor spaces. So that was a nice place to be there for a while. And then from there, I kind of bounced around a little bit. So I would say Grand Forks, North Dakota wasn't on my list of places that I really wanted to move to, but it was probably the best decision of my life to move here. So in 2022-2023, I tied on a short stint at the University of Colorado at Boulder and split my time between that and a government lab. And that was a great experience to have before I took the job here. So I signed on in March 2023. And while I was still in Colorado, I was already planning this facility. So we didn't lose any time.
Joining my conversation with Dr. Marcus Alguer, he's the assistant professor of physics and astrophysics at the University of North Dakota. And we're talking about the space laser project that he's been working on and now has come to fruition. I understand that since you arrived, a major milestone has happened, many major milestones perhaps, but just days ago, you lifted a giant telescope onto the roof of UND's Whitmer Hall. Can you talk about what happened, what it means, and what it took to build the facility?
Yeah, for sure. That was an exciting day and a half, for sure, when you plan a big project like that for 2.5 years, and then it ends up dangling off a crane cable. So that was a day. That was a little stressful, but also exciting, and everything is on the roof. And
yeah, we're not in the 65, 80 degree range here either when you're doing this stuff.
No, and there it helps when you have local contractors from the region to work with. So our crane operators were local to the Grand Forks area. The company that built this telescope is out of Michigan, so no one was surprised to find winter weather in December. So that helped. But yeah, I mean, it was a it was a journey. When we started planning this in 2023, there were no commercial products that you could buy like this. So a lot of the equipment that we're buying to put this facility together were developed in the process. So for example, this telescope and enclosure that we just installed has serial number 2. And serial number 1 was installed for a different customer the same week.
So this is all brand new. You've got a ground station now. Give us a sense on what the day-to-day use of that will be, and how does it then pair up with communicating with actual satellites in orbit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So the ground stage is not complete, right? This is the core, the heart, the beating heart of this ground station are the optics that we now have, that we need to collect light from satellites and direct light towards satellites. So there are two components to this, right? It's a research facility, so we can work on things that aren't really commercial yet and try out new protocols or new way to encode information on light or new way to collecting lights or try to overcome the bounds of the technology that we have right now. And then the other parts is that we have this operational ground station where the idea is that any kind of customers that could be other researchers within the university or North Dakota or at other universities or even private companies who are operating satellites or trying to build satellites or want to test equipment can either come here and use the facility or remotely use the ground station. So the dream is that people will use this maybe within a network of more ground stations to downlink data from a weather satellite, for example. So hopefully one day I come to work and I see that the telescope is turning, so I know it's tracking a satellite and doing its job.
So this is, as you said, a research facility, an educational facility. How are UND students involved in the project?
They will be involved a lot. So of course, most of our research goes through students, right? I don't do any research by myself. It's always with master's and PhD students and even undergrad students that we involve in research whenever we can. But it's not just the research component. For example, right, something I forgot to mention, this whole initiative is very interdisciplinary. It lives in all colleges and all departments at UND. So for example, there is a satellite operations student group in the space studies department, and they have their own two satellites that they can practice with and learn how to operate satellites, the day-to-day business. And we want to involve them in using these optical ground stations. We have things like our senior design projects in the engineering departments where companies and collaborative teams of engineering students can work together on projects, and we want to involve those projects with this ground station. And then finally, I'm hoping that we can start elective courses where students can directly learn how to run the station and then get hands-on skills that they can take into industry jobs.
Give me an idea of the laser. I have the little laser pointer that I use when I present. This has got to be way different than that. What's the difference?
You need to be about 10,000 times brighter.
Yeah.
But that's not the only difference, right? If you took a visible laser like your laser pointer and turned it up to 11, that would not be very, very safe to be around. Not on campus, not for our students, and not for as you mentioned, maybe aircrafts who might be in the path of our laser. So what we're using is infrared lasers. So they're beyond.
So this is not in the visible spectrum then.
No, they're invisible. And so there are two advantages to that, right? If you would talk to someone at the FAA about shooting lasers at the sky, they would first of all not be happy about that. But so the two things we're not allowed to do is we're not allowed to distract crews on aircraft, and we're not allowed to harm them. And the infrared laser gets you around both of those things. So lasers are invisible, so you don't even know that they're there.
Infrared to me means maybe also heat. Is it? Do we have a heat issue here?
Not really, because those lasers are a lot more powerful than your small laser pointer, but not that powerful that you would feel them as heat. That's one of the advantages of laser communication, that you need only very low power to do all of this compared to radio frequency. But so the wavelength of light that we're using is so far in the infrared that it does not pass through the cornea, so through the front part of our eye. So it does not reach the sensitive part, which is the retina. So those lasers, we call them eye safe. So they're invisible and they're eye safe. And the other thing is, you can imagine you start out with a small beam, but that beam will diverge, as we call it. Basically, the beam will get bigger and bigger and bigger as you get away from your optics. So at the altitude that aircraft are flying, for example, the beam will be so large that for the area of your pupil in your eye, so the light that you actually see, it will be less powerful than your laser pointer.
Give me a sense of how it diverges. Are we talking millimeters or smaller, or maybe even a little larger than that to, let's say, a low orbit flying satellite?
You would always be larger. So we're starting out with about 4 inches for the diameter of the beam. And then by the time you're reaching a low Earth orbit, so let's say 200, 300 miles, the beam diameter would be more or less something like a football field. So it still spreads out.
That's very interesting. All the science fiction stuff we've ever seen for a laser, right, is this beam. And it's a solid beam. And it's not that wide for sure. Certainly not as wide as a football field. Yet, even though it grows, so to speak, you can still communicate back and forth with a laser that is that wide.
You can. And you can do it better than you could with radio frequencies, because for radio communication, you have something like a beam, but it basically just goes everywhere. So you're sending the energy that you're putting into that communication in all directions, and then wherever your satellite is, it picks up a little bit of that. So we're still not perfectly hitting that satellite, but we're not overfilling it by quite as much.
So if I were a student and I'm hearing this and this is cool, I want to be part of this, what would you tell that high school student to study in high school before they come and see you?
Anything related to STEM, science and math are the basis for this, right?
So this did not end up at a federal lab. It ended up at the University of North Dakota. That is significant to me. You've worked in the federal workplace. You talked about that earlier. Does this surprise you that a university is doing this type of work?
It does not surprise me. And here is why. So government labs are amazing places, right? It's a very different environment from a university. You will have staff scientists there who have worked in their field for 30 years, and they're still going to the lab every day and tinkering with stuff. So there's an incredible wealth of knowledge and incredible facilities there. But they don't do as much workforce training as you can as a university. So where you would enter a government lab would usually be at the PhD level. And there's not that many job openings there before that. So they don't train undergraduate students, for example, to do specific jobs. So that's something we can do here that you can't do at government labs. And depending on the lab, they can be very closed off, right? Where I worked in Boulder is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. It's a lab within the Department of Commerce, right? They're famous for things like selling a standard peanut butter product for the peanut butter industry. So they mostly do standards and reference products. If you buy a mattress that is flame retardant, it has been tested with a NIST standard cigarette. So the Department of Commerce is not very closed off about what they do, but a Department of Defense lab might be very different there, right? So the main advantage that we have is we can do workforce training, we can work with students, we can incorporate industry, and we can let them on site and let them touch the equipment. And that's something you can't do that easily at a government lab.
Just curious, you're working with satellites, communication with satellites from ground. Do you also see this technology evolving to tower-to-tower communications on the Earth's surface, or is that all going to be in fiber cables that are now strung everywhere?
I think that'll most likely stay in fiber cables, just because there's already such a good backbone of optical fiber infrastructure all over the world.
So, Dr. Aguiar, as we kind of wind this conversation up, what are you most excited about as this project moves forward? What are the next milestones that you are really psyched about?
The thing I'm most excited about is that, you know, we can take students who come from this region, who are from the upper Midwest, and train them for these very demanding and skilled jobs that are also in the upper Midwest, right? We have, as I mentioned, the SDA moving in next door. We have their contractors moving in, and they're hiring out of UND and other universities in the region. And at least for what I do, like the optics and the quantum science, that hasn't happened before yet here. And where I was before, like Colorado and Oregon, they have these amazing ecosystems of like high-tech industry and universities working together. And I want to have that here too, because I don't, you know, the students that we get as undergraduate students, they're simply excited about doing science and doing engineering. And maybe they haven't thought that far ahead where they're going to work after. And I want to be able to point them towards a job that's here in the region, right? I don't want to see them move 1,000 miles away for a job when they really want to stay here. That's what I'm most excited about, that we can have this local
best wishes here. for sure, and good luck with the project. My guest is Dr. Marcus Algier. He's a physics professor at the University of North Dakota, leading a new laser communication optical ground station, better known for him and maybe for his students as the Space Laser. Through his work, UND students are helping pioneer a technology that can transform how we receive data from space. And it's been a pleasure visiting with you, Dr. Algier. Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you. It's my pleasure too.
Still ahead on today's Main Street, are you looking for a way to make your holiday generosity go further without guesswork? That's coming up right after this. Street continues on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and as the year winds down, many nonprofits are asking supporters to give, but some are finding creative ways to make giving feel more personal, more tangible, and more impactful. The God's Child Project has been working for more than three decades to improve the lives of children and families in Guatemala, Honduras, and in the United States, focusing on education, healthcare, housing, and long-term community development. And right now, they're in the middle of a busy and critical holiday season that includes a 12 days of wish list, a peer-to-peer fundraising push to finish the year strong, and a miracle match that will triple donations as the new year begins. Joining us today on Main Street is Sarah Rivers, the multi-state event coordinator for the God's Child Project, to walk us through these campaigns and explain how listeners can take part in ways that fit their budget, their networks, and their values. Sarah, it's a pleasure. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be a part of this. North Dakota has been a huge part of what we do. Huge supporters come from the area, so I'm really thankful to have the chance to talk with you and kind of rope the community in on some of the important things we have going on right now.
Go ahead. And let's set the table. Tell us what your history is, what your mission is, and what's your scope.
So to start with our mission statement, I feel like that's the, you know, that's the backbone of every organization. So our mission is breaking the bitter chains of poverty through education, healthcare, housing, and sustainable development. So Patrick Atkinson, who is our founder and executive director, founded the God's Child Project in 1991. So it's really exciting because going into 2026, we are entering our 35th anniversary. So the work we do is in Guatemala, some of other countries in Central America, some local work as well. We have the Dreamer Center in Antigua, Guatemala, and that's where we hold our programs that provides the education, healthcare, housing, and sustainable development down there.
Sarah, your website emphasizes that you work for long-term solutions, not just short-term aid. Why is that approach so central to how God's Child Project operates?
I think it's really important. We don't want to just help children, babies, single mothers and families for, you know, a month and then let them go off and potentially fall back into trouble. We want to give them the right tools to set them up for success, not just for the year, but for years to come after that. So it's really important to build on that sustainable development. That's something we emphasize a lot, is giving them the tools to make their lives improve long term.
Sarah, you emphasize that your work is around four pillars, and we've talked about them already: education, healthcare, housing, and sustainable development. Why do those four areas matter so much for breaking cycles of poverty?
Yeah. So starting with that education aspect, that's kind of the backbone of, you know, setting children, starting from a young age, but even educating adults, to setting them up for that success, to potentially dig them out of that impoverished hole they may be in currently. So the education aspect, especially down at our ANA Dreamer Center in Guatemala, we provide resources for children and after school program. We give them meals at that program. That may be their only meal that day. We provide education for adults as well, setting them up for entrepreneur skills, ways to manage their money, ways to kind of learn different skills like sewing or, you know, different kind of basic skills that could set them up for big success in the future. So that education part is a really good starting point with that. Healthcare as well gives the children, we have Casa Jackson Hospital for malnourished babies in our Dreamer Center as well. So that sets up children who have been severely malnourished, get them up to their goal weight, and then send them on to live a healthy life after that. And then housing too, we send service teams from America, but also we've had like teams from Canada, Spain, go down, build houses for families who may have lost it in natural disasters or things like that. So all those pillars, I mean, are just so crucial for the communities that we serve, and they're each so important in their own ways.
Who do you recruit to help you with education, with healthcare, with housing? Are these people that come and go? Is it almost like mission work, Sarah?
We have a whole staff down in Guatemala, down at ANA, at our Dreamer Center, who specialize in those things. And we have nurses at our Casa Jackson Hospital that stick around. But also, I will say, when we do have service teams go down to build houses, a lot of those volunteers stay at the Dreamer Center, too, for a couple of days to help with the education part of things. We've had nurses from the U.S. go down to Casa Jackson to help with the baby patients there. So it's a mixture of both, but we do have staffing down there, which is really great.
Sarah, let's start with a 12 days of wish list. What is the campaign, and why did you choose to run it during this particular window in December?
Yeah, great question. So every year, or at least for the past couple years, we create a wish list, which is just a list of 20 items that are really essential and crucial to the communities we serve. And they range from an orange tree being planted in a family's yard all the way up to you could sponsor a home build for $3,000. So it really ranges in price and need. So it kind of gives people and donors and supporters an idea of what their money could go towards or what the cost is for some of these things. So sometimes people think that they can, you know, we only want huge donations, which is always great, obviously, but also just on our wish list, you know, we have $25 provides 12 meals for children, or $17 provides that orange tree. So it kind of gives supporters and followers an idea of where their money could go to, especially this time of year. So there's 20 items total. And then on social media, we've been highlighting 12 items, so one per day, kind of going along with the holiday theme of things, kind of making it fun and something people want to join in on. So the 12 items we're featuring range in price and goal and needs. So it's just kind of a fun little social media campaign to get more people involved and get them to really see where their money could go towards.
Sarah, can you give us an example of the kind of tangible impact meeting one of these wish list items really has had or will have on a child or family? It's one thing to say, okay, I planted an orange tree, but what does that mean?
Yeah. So even just doing that, you know, simple task, it's simple to us, but to these families, it can mean so much. An orange tree provides nutrition for years to come, just with that little price of $17. We have, you know, $20 funds a full day of diapers at Casa Jackson for our patients. So it's things that sometimes we would take for granted that means just so much to the communities we serve down in Guatemala. And just kind of seeing the impact of that, like the $25 that provides the 12 meals for these children is just, it's so impactful and it means so much to these children and families and women.
Sarah, you mentioned earlier that you also provide assistance in the United States. What does that look like?
Yeah, so recently, Patrick, our founder, and I were talking, and he has been doing a lot of support and help for families and people in need in the North Dakota and Minneapolis, St. Paul area with the cold front that has come in recently, just donating hundreds of pounds of clothing, essentials, blankets, pillows, things that these people in need need right now. Especially, you know, I'm coming from Minneapolis, so we've been in the negative degree weather. I know it's similar for North Dakota too. So it could be a really scary time for those who may not have shelter. Helping locally is also something very important to the project as well.
The 12 Days of Wishlist project, you're hoping that people can take part before December 19th. For someone listening right now, what's the simplest way folks could take part?
Yeah, so if you go to our website, which is godschild.org, right when you go on our landing page, it is a link or a button you could click to go to our wish list. And it has them all listed there. And we also have, right when you go on the website, something pops up about our wish list. You could access it easily there. Also, if you follow our Instagram, which is the Godschild Project, each post, like I said, for the next few days or so, it's going to be one post a day about this wish list still as we wrap it up. And there's a link in the caption for those that send you right there.
We're enjoying our conversation today with Sarah Rivers. She's a multi-state event coordinator for the God's Child Project. She's walking us through how this campaign works and how to explain how listeners can take part in ways that fit their budget, network, and their values. Sarah, you're also encouraging supporters to create their own fundraising pages this month. It's a peer-to-peer giving program, and it's a powerful tool. Mm-hmm. Explain it to us.
Yeah, so peer-to-peer fundraising, for those who may not be so familiar, I'm sure many people have heard of GoFundMe. It's basically a way for people to reach different audiences for us that we couldn't reach on our own. So I created a campaign through GoFundMe called Let's Finish 2025 Strong, and it's encouraging our followers and supporters to create their own fundraising page off of that campaign to share with their family, friends, followers. Peer-to-peer fundraising has become very prevalent within the last 10 years or so, reaching different demographics of people. So we're encouraging our supporters, followers, to create their own page, give their why, give their story of why the project means so much for them and why we're trying to raise funds, especially before the end of the year. So kind of just getting other people involved, it's a great way to spread our mission, spread our word to people who may not follow us socially or have even heard about us. It's a good way to reach people.
Sarah, I'm curious, have you looked at to see where peer-to-peer campaigns are really appealing? Is it for church members? Is it for families, coworkers, students, seniors, or all of the above?
Kind of all of the above, especially with social media being how as prevalent as it is now. It's so easy to create your own fundraising page, post your link to your Facebook, and have your followers check it out and maybe even donate if they feel called to do so. But yeah, I mean, church groups, that's a popular group of people that may partake. We've noticed the rise of student age people getting involved in donating and fundraising. And it's very prevalent to them, the younger generation who use social media often, to create a page like this and share it with their family and friends. So really, we're trying to hit everyone that we can, no matter what the demographic is. We've been really encouraging past supporters, maybe past service team members, to create their page because they've seen firsthand like what we do and the impact it has.
You have a Triple the Impact project coming up. I believe it's from December 20th through January 5th. What is it? And what is this miracle match that I've heard about?
Yeah, so it's a larger campaign that we're running December 20th through January 5th. Every donation made during that two-ish weeks is going to be tripled. We have four very generous donors who have agreed to match those donations three times, which is just amazing and will make all the difference in the world. You know, $100 suddenly becomes $300 just like that. And it's so impactful and so important going into the new year. We want to build this strong momentum up going into 2026, our anniversary year. We have, you know, more people than ever part of the programs that we serve down in Guatemala. So it's just a really, really important campaign, finishing out the holiday season and going into the new year, just because of that triple match is huge and can make a really big difference.
I understand that 2026 is your 35th anniversary?
Yes.
All right, so correct. Tell me, as someone who works closely with supporters and donors, what motivates you, especially during this busy holiday season, to continue with this cause?
Yeah, I think a couple months ago, I went down to Guatemala for the first time to see our programs firsthand in work. And just seeing the true impact support provides for these children, women, families that we serve all year round down there, it's just so important. And it once you see it firsthand, it really drives something in you to want it to keep going. And we need our supporters and all that to keep doing so. So it's so important that people know of all the important things we have coming up before the end of the year and going into 2026, trying to build momentum and excitement of this is really important. And, you know, real people's lives are being changed because of the support that we have. And it's really great to see.
Sarah, some people may be wondering, of all the places in the world, why did you choose Guatemala?
That's a good question. Patrick has a footprint in many places around the world. He's done so much for different communities, which is really, really great. He would be much better at answering that question since he is the one that started it up down there. But I know, like many places around the world, Guatemala has a lot of poverty, a lot of people that need our help urgently. And it's grown a lot down there, which is really great. But he would definitely be better at answering that question just because he is the force behind it and the one that started everything.
Sarah, if you'd like to leave our listeners with one thing about God's Child Project that you would want them to remember as we head into the new year, what would you hope that would be?
Mm-hmm. I would say just remembering the importance of keeping communities like this in your thoughts, prayers, whatever you may believe in is really important, and realizing that there are people out there that really need our assistance and support and help. And it's really important to keep that in mind, especially going into the new year, but also just year round in general. I know the holiday season is big with giving, which is really great, but I think it's also important to realize that these people need our help year round. So to just keep that in mind, we have a lot of big things coming up next year with our anniversary and just keeping the momentum going, helping these communities. So I just hope people realize that we want to build momentum year round, not just holiday season or busy season, but just keeping these families and communities always in our thoughts is really important.
Sarah, as we wind up our conversation, you do recruit volunteers to be perhaps service team, to have service team experiences. Are these school groups, corporate teams, community and church groups that are interested in what can they do if they want to learn more?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So it could be anyone. We get a lot of churches, we get a lot of schools, but also just groups of friends or groups of families that want to go down and experience this wonderful mission. Eliza Streeter is our service team and volunteer coordinator. Her email is on our website. She would be the person to contact if anyone wants any more information of what that may look like when it comes to service teams and volunteering. I recruit volunteers more in the U.S. area of who wants to maybe help us out with fundraising events across the United States. We're really trying to grow that aspect of things. So I would be the one to contact with that, but Eliza would be who you want to email or call with any service team questions.
And there is a specific call on the website for folks who would want to volunteer in the Bismarck office. There are needs for administrative and clerical work, event volunteers, as well as volunteers to do some sorting. All right, Sarah, one more time. How can people learn more?
Yes, you could always visit our website at www.godschild.org. I encourage you to follow us on Facebook, too, as we post updates about down in Guatemala, what we're doing maybe locally. Staff updates, as well as all of our campaigns, will be posted there as well. And that's at the God's Child Project on Facebook.
That's Sarah Rivers, multi-state event coordinator for the God's Child Project. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
It's Michelle Martin. Every weekday morning, my Morning Edition co-host and I have some questions.
What do you say to that concern from voters that there needs to
be... Can this squarely be laid on the feet of the government shutdown, or are there deeper problems?
Do you agree it's important for government officials to be truthful before Congress?
Get information, context, accountability on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 15th. On this date in 1911, the Wahpeton-Breckenridge community was still reeling from the events of the previous week. Word-of-mouth versions of the story circulated until the weekly newspapers came out. Richland County Sheriff and popular veterinarian George Doc Moody had gone with two young men to serve eviction papers on a stranger illegally occupying a farmhouse west of Wahpeton. When Moody stepped onto the porch, the man shot him with a rifle, fired at the others, and escaped with their buggy. Mooney managed to fire one shot before dying. One of the young men rode Moody's horse to town to raise the alarm. The killer had made bizarre statements at the door and was thought to be a man recently escaped from the asylum. Wahpeton Mayor Emberly instructed a posse to bring him back, dead or alive. They caught up with him near the South Dakota border and ended his life after he ran into a slough and fired at them. Moody's funeral drew people from all over the county. Businesses closed for the service. No one mourned for Moody's killer, except for his family in Nebraska. To them, he was a good man, a son, and a brother. His name was Bert Hudson. Hudson was not an escaped patient, but a farmhand experiencing mental problems after the loss of a family member. His grieving mother and sister wrote a wrenching letter from Nebraska, pleading for Bert's body so they could give him a proper funeral and bury him beside his father and sister. A Grand Forks man had communicated with the family and received the letter. They learned that Hudson's body had been sent to the medical training department of the state university. The sister wrote, "I cannot understand how the body of my brother is still there, but I have heard such things are done." Donaldson Studio in Wahpeton made and sold a postcard titled, "The Man Who Shot Sheriff Moody," using the post-mortem photo. Gruesome postcards and newspaper photos of crimes and their victims and perpetrators were commonplace at the time. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. Join me Tuesday for Morning Edition on Prairie Public. NPR will bring you news from the nation and the world, and I'll have the latest stories from North Dakota and the Prairie region, along with the day's weather. Listen beginning at 4 a.m. Central on member-supported Prairie Public, North Dakota's home for NPR.
Music.
And that's it for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll visit with Nate Mickelberg. He's the Director of Communications for the Dakota Medical Foundation, an organization focused on building healthier communities across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.
There is a wind advisory for portions of western and central North Dakota late tonight through tomorrow. Mostly cloudy tonight, becoming breezy to windy, patchy blowing and drifting snow in the east. Lows from around 10 in the east to the 30s in the west, and temperatures steady to rising throughout the night. And tomorrow on Tuesday, mostly sunny and windy, highs in the upper 30s to the mid 40s. That's your weather from member-supported Prairie Public. Up next hour, all things considered.